This is number 0084, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0084. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet T. Krulos, who is a writer whose blog and upcoming book is entitled Heroes of the Night, about the people who dress up in superhero costumes and then go out patrolling the streets. Just who are these people?
When you first hear this story, I think a lot of people have a very knee-jerk reaction where they're like, oh, these are all dorky guys living in their mom's basement or something like that. And what I found was that there is a huge amount of diversity as far as the people doing it. Different religions, different politics, different economic backgrounds. That's really what became fascinating to me, was that the only thing that they kind of shared in common was they wanted to get out there and do something good and help their neighbors.
Chaz Pazienza is a new media consultant and a columnist for the Huffington Post. He has an opinion on many things, including the recent sale of the Huffington Post.
Ariana and her partners just made $315 million selling, some say selling out, the Huffington Post to what is really, what has always been, since its inception, the most sort of pedestrian, lowest common denominator, a path of least resistance to the internet, the service provider that's ever existed in this country. AOL has always been sort of, I really don't mean to be disparaging, but sort of the idiot's way to the internet. Anybody could use it. They prided themselves on that.
Darren Taylor is also known as Professor Splash. He owns the record for high diving into a kiddie pool. Why do such a dangerous stunt?
That's all over, and I don't know why I do it. I locked into it. I'm very fortunate to do it, but there's a good side and there's a dark side of this thing. But it's a feel-good story, but on my side, it's drastic and it can wear on you, and it's killing me inside, and I want to get rid of it.
And, of course, we have lots and lots and lots of stuff and an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0084, is Ramon Stoppelenburg, an entrepreneur who lives in Cambodia and who is working to keep the Flix movie theater there open. You may remember him from his letmestayforaday.com travels. Well, he exchanged Amsterdam, the Netherlands, for Cambodia, to be exact, Phnom Penh, to enjoy life more. And then halfway through March, he found out that the local hotspots for a lot of expats in Phnom Penh, the cinema named The Flix, was going to close its doors. Well, Ramon decided that he would take over the cinema and preserve the only place in Cambodia that shows Western-oriented movies to an expat community. He launched the website, which is www.timetohelp.me, where he explains his entire goal. Now, you can help him save The Flix Cinema with a small contribution in the form of a loan, which you get refunded it for after about 6 months, or as a one-time donation, which will become a microcredit on Kiva.org. Again, we had Ramon on the program a little while ago talking about his other entrepreneurial business, which is cooking tours through Europe. He's a very interesting guy indeed. So if he puts his mind to doing this and saving this theater, I know it will work out. Again, I thank you very much, Ramon, for doing this late on this edition of the Stuff File program. And you can check out all the information about Ramon by going to my website. All the links at thestufffile.com will be there so you can find out more info. Thank you again, Ramon, for the slate on this edition of the show. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, here's a story to remind you that every country in the world has its own Lindsay Lohan. 28-year-old Romanian TV star Simona Suhoi was caught driving without a license. That's a pretty big deal over there, and she was actually facing up to 5 years in jail after police found her behind the wheel a month after she was banned from driving. So she's doing what any self-respecting diva would do. She's blaming it all on her breast implants. In fact, she called it an implant emergency, which I think is filed under the same category as wardrobe malfunction. Anyway, Simona says, I admit I shouldn't have been driving the car, but I had no other choice. You see, I was having terrible pains in the chest. I think it was because of those brand new breast implants. I tried to get a taxi, but they were all busy, so I jumped into the car and dashed for the clinic. I mean, what was I supposed to do? Oh, I don't know. Chest pains? Perhaps call an ambulance? Anyway, Simona had her license suspended when she was involved in a traffic accident and says she will contest the charge in court. Well, you know, if she ends up in jail after this lame excuse, perhaps she deserves the time that's coming to her. After all, it's tit for tat, I say. Anyway, moving right along, what kind of mother hires a babysitter she knows is a drug addict? Well, the kind who pays her babysitter in drugs, of course. In Missoula, Montana, 27-year-old Michaela Dion Brills was charged with criminal distribution of dangerous drugs after she confessed to her probation officer. She claims in exchange for babysitting services on several occasions, she had given her neighbor 20 to 30 generic Xanax pills and about 20 Zolpidem, which is a sleep medication. Both women are now in a bit of trouble. Well, right off the bat, the telltale line for me was that she confessed to her probation officer. The fact that she has a probation officer speaks volumes. And like I've always said, anybody can be a parent, but you need a license to get a dog. In Akron, Ohio, Ken Falzini doesn't have one of the world's most popular jobs. He's a repo man, and he had the fun task of repossessing the Lexus of Bishop Mark Neal of Akron's Jerusalem Missionary Baptist Church. It seems Bishop Neal forgot to keep making the payments on his car. As Falzini went about his job, Bishop Neal suddenly jumped into the car and tried to drive off. Falzini grabbed onto the hood and suddenly found himself clinging for dear life as Neal began sharp zigzagging at speeds of up to 50 miles per hour. Falzini said, at times, Bishop Neal was laughing. He added, "I thought, man, is this what Jesus would do?" Apparently not. Bishop Neal was arrested and charged with felony assault. He told reporters he thought it was disrespectful for Falzini to try to repossess a preacher's car during Sunday services. Well, gee, I don't know if it's disrespectful. Actually, you know, I think it makes perfect sense. I mean, you need to repo a preacher's car? At least you know where it's going to be on Sunday morning. Ah, the Lord giveth, and the Lord taketh away. And while we're on a twisted religious theme, in Britain, Colin Howell was convicted last year of a double murder of his wife and his girlfriend's husband. However, he's back in court testifying against the girlfriend, who's on trial for the same crimes. In his testimony, he admitted that he frequently drugged the girlfriend during sex at her own request. It seems she wished to be unconscious during sex so that she would not be bothered by Christian guilt over the extramarital affair that they were having. Again, the Lord works in mysterious ways, and apparently he has a sense of humor. I wonder how much guilt she has, by the way, Christian guilt, over a double murder. And finally, in this section of the Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest, it's not unusual in Anchorage, Alaska, to see a wild moose meandering around town, but it is unusual for residents to reach out to pet the huge beasts. A 20-something-year-old woman in Town Square Park did just that, police say. In response, the animal kicked the unnamed woman several times, including in the chest, but paramedics said she didn't need hospital treatment. "At this time, we are telling people not to agitate the moose," a police spokeswoman said, confirming that officers did not shoot the moose, nor even try to get it removed from town. It was just doing what moose do. And she, that woman, was doing just what oblivious do. You know, Sarah Palin in a helicopter with a gun is never around when you need her, apparently. Anyway, let's get to our first guest on the Stuff File program, shall we? T. Krulos is a blogger who writes about the phenomenon of people who dress up as superheroes who have sprung up in many cities. His blog is entitled Heroes of the Night, which is also the title of his upcoming book. It would appear that scores of costume crusaders have joined the superhero movement. T. is on the line with us from Milwaukee. Hi, T.
Hi, thanks for having me.
This is growing to be a big deal. I've seen many news reports over the last little while dealing with this. First of all, where did this spring up from initially?
Well, the interesting things was through research, I found out that there were people doing this here and there since the 70s, actually. But it didn't really grow into being a large phenomenon until about the mid-2000s. Around 2005, 2006, it really started to pick up, and soon there was hundreds of people doing it all over the world.
What brought you to decide to write this book? What was your interest in these everyday superheroes?
Well, first of all, I've been a comic book fan since I was a little kid. You know, and like every other kid, I always thought about how awesome it would be to be a superhero. So I started seeing a couple of news reports on these guys, and I was like, wow, I wonder if there's one here in Milwaukee. I'd really like to meet him. And I'm a freelance writer, so I was like, I'm sure I could get a good magazine article out of meeting one of these guys. So I did some Google searching and found out that Milwaukee has a superhero named The Watchman. And we set up a meeting at a city park one night. I was just kind of walking around the park, and then I looked over and saw him walking through the park wearing his mask and his gear. I was like, wow, this guy is real. And I talked to him for a long time that night and just became very fascinated with why he was doing this and about this larger movement or subculture of people and what they were all about. So I decided there's definitely enough material for a book and started working on that.
So since meeting the Watchman in your city and finding out his story, doing the research on many others, do you find there's a commonality amongst them all, besides the costume, for instance, or the costumes that they wear? Is there a commonality as to why they started doing this in the first place or why they continue to do it?
Not exactly. That was actually one of the surprising things that I found out, because when you first hear this story, I think a lot of people have a very knee-jerk reaction where they're like, oh, these are all dorky guys living in their mom's basement or something like that. And what I found was that there is a huge amount of diversity as far as the people doing it. Different religions, different politics, different economic backgrounds. So that's really what became fascinating to me, was that the only thing that they kind of shared in common was they wanted to get out there and do something good and help their neighbors.
See, I wouldn't have even gone the geeky lives in their parents' basement type of person. I would have, if I was going to come up with a knee-jerk reaction, I would have gone the other direction. Thrill seeker?
Well, sure, you know, they want to help people, and I think that part of the appeal is having a small sort of adventure along the way.
With the attention that they're now getting, because you say they've been around for years, and it's almost ironic that people like this have been around for years and they're in costumes, so it's not like they're hard to miss if you happen to see one, but with attention like your blog, the book, news reports that are popping up here, there, and everywhere, does it become somewhat problematic that it would, A, attract attention to them for some of the things they do and maybe they don't want the attention, and B, bring out other people who want to be superheroes for all the wrong reasons?
Yeah, well, absolutely. Yes to both of those things. Some of these guys don't want media attention. They're not interested at all. And I think that we could definitely be seeing people who get into it just because they want the media attention, which, of course, isn't a very heroic angle to go for. So, yeah, that's something that's going to be interesting to see, because they've been attracting tons of media attention across the board over the last couple of months in particular.
Have you done any research with various law enforcement agencies and their feelings about these superheroes?
Yeah, I've always tried to talk to police wherever I've gone. I've gone to a couple of different cities to meet the superheroes there. Generally, their attitude, at least what they are willing to say, has been pretty similar. They say, we appreciate that there's people trying to help other people out and help us out, but they're concerned about their safety, of course, because, you know, anything could go wrong. And some of these guys do have some training and some don't. So, I mean, it's dangerous. It's dangerous just walking down the street without looking for trouble sometimes.
The way I found you, I found you through your blog, but I initially saw a recent People magazine article about this whole phenomenon. Again, it goes back to the question I was saying, asking before. This is becoming very mainstream, even discussing this now, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, there's the People magazine story. There was a front page article in the Wall Street Journal, actually. There's a documentary titled Superheroes, which premiered at the Slamdance Film Festival and should be getting some distribution this summer. And it's a documentary about real-life superheroes. And actually, you know, worldwide, there's a British superhero who had a series of articles about him in the British tabloids, of all places. So, yeah, lots of media and international media, too.
Have you had an opportunity to talk to any of the people who have been helped by these superheroes?
No, I guess that's difficult to do because a lot of times we don't know who those people are. It's the same thing. I would love to actually talk to a criminal that's been thwarted by a real-life superhero, but of course that's hard to do because we don't know their names.
Yeah, you would think, though, especially, as you say, thwarted by a criminal, or thwarted by a superhero, I'm just wondering, surely there must be somebody out there who's been arrested who was committing some sort of crime, and one of these superheroes stepped in, and then the cops came in and did their thing, and I'm just wondering, do these people have to then go and testify?
Yeah, I think that they would be willing to testify. Some of them are more secretive about their identities than others. But I think that most of these guys have a very responsible approach. If they see a crime, a lot of them tell me they're going to call the police first before they try to intervene. And a lot of them have said, you know, they're willing to testify and cooperate with the police. They don't want to. They don't think they're above the police, you know.
So what do they do? Do they, people with day jobs, they get into their costume and they wander the streets just sort of like a costumed neighborhood watch?
Yeah, exactly. I compare it to that exact phrasing quite a bit. They're just walking around, making sure that their neighbors are okay. We'll call something in if something is an intense situation and they can help defuse it. They will.
So why do it in the costume?
Yes. Why do it in the costume?
Yeah.
Well, I've heard different reasoning. Some do it because they kind of want to attract attention as far as they want people to be inspired by seeing, you know, everyday people dressed as superheroes, kind of taking the fight to the street. Others say, you know, it's to protect their identity because they don't want people knowing that they're doing this, like their coworkers, for example. And yeah, like I said, I think some of it is just the adventure of putting on a costume and, you know, heading out to the street.
After doing the research and writing the book, as you say, you were a comic book fan growing up. Does this make you want to be a superhero yourself or less so?
I think I'm pretty comfortable with where I am right now. I get to live vicariously through the real-life superheroes, and I get to talk to them about their adventures. So I think that's good enough for me. But I see the appeal of it. And, you know, like a story that I like to tell is I had a friend who is very badly mugged. She was a female. They punched her in the face. They stole like $20 off of her. And when, you know, when I heard that story, I was very angry. And of course, you know, I wish that I could have been dressed up as Batman hiding in the shadows or something to scare those creeps off. So I see the appeal of it for sure.
Well, T, I thank you very much for talking with us. Again, the book, the blog is Heroes of the Night. The book is the same title, Heroes of the Night, Inside the Real Life Superhero Movement. And I thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
T. Krulos, who writes the blog Heroes of the Night. His book of the same title, Heroes of the Night, Inside the Real Life Superhero Movement, will be coming out in the summer. In the meantime, you can check out his blog for updates on the superhero movement. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the Stuff File program page for this show, which is show number 0084, and you'll find links to T's blog.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander's show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Choosy mothers choose the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. If your mother didn't choose it for you, well, I guess she just doesn't love you.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to Ches Pazienza, who's a columnist with the Huffington Post, and we'll meet Professor Splash, also known as Darren Taylor. Plus, we have an idiot of the day and lots more stuff for you. Stuff right here, right now, as a matter of fact. In Phoenix, 21-year-old Rachel Brock was arrested for an alleged sexual relationship with an underage boy. Now, the weird thing is that her mother, Susan Brock, had already been arrested for sexually abusing the same boy. And, amazingly, neither Rachel nor her mother knew about each other's affair with the boy. Wow, the apple really doesn't fall far from the tree, huh? Okay, what is it about this boy? That's what I want to know. His prom night is going to be rather anticlimactic, don't you think? Here's to you, Mrs. Robinson. Coo-coo-ca-choo, Mrs. Robinson. And speaking of cougars, while dating a cougar may be the new hot thing, you don't ever want to cross one. The cougar in this story is 92-year-old Helen B. Stottinger, and the younger man is 53-year-old Dwight Bettner. Now, Helen says the relationship soured because of Dwight's constant lies and the fact that he refused to pay his own way when they ate out together. Now, I've checked into the story a little further. Apparently, the only time they ate out together is after he had done something for her around the house, their neighbors, and she took him out to dinner. So that's it. She might be a little delusional. Anyway, eventually, Dwight told her that he wanted her to leave him alone and refused to give her a kiss when she was visiting his home. Oh, by the way, Dwight has a girlfriend. Anyway, she responded by allegedly firing 4 shots into his home in Fort McCoy, Florida. So she was arrested and is facing charges of aggravated assault with a firearm and shooting into an occupied dwelling. Wow. Shooting up a so-called boyfriend's home at the age of 92. Doesn't make you really want to know more about her early dating life? Maybe check under the floorboards of her home while we're at it. Or at least underneath her backyard. Yeah, there's a history of that woman that we know nothing about. Nothing about. Anyway, one more story in the Stuff File program news before we get to our next guest. Let's talk about chickens! Cornwall, United Kingdom, is famous for its Cornish hens. So much so that 31-year-old citizen David Roberts has opened the Chicken Hotel to provide 5-star service for pampered hens while their owners are away. Business is booming on his farm in Helston, and he has bookings as far ahead as Christmas. Oh, I love Christmas chicken. Anyway. During the day, the feathered guests range freely in the fox-proof grounds before being rounded up and put to bed in their luxury coops at night. Rates are around $3 per coop per night, plus $1 per chicken, which includes meals. So we guess that makes it an all-inclusive chicken resort. Roberts even transports the birds to and from their homes if the owners require it, and offers a nursery for chicks and an incubation service for eggs that need hatching. Wow, speaking as a person who loves eating chicken, that's about the silliest thing I've ever heard. You know, chicken really is the miracle food. It's the only thing we eat before it's born and after it's dead. Good eats. Good eats. Yeah. Let's get to our next guest on the Stuff File program, shall we? Chez Pazienza is a veteran network news producer and a regular contributor to the Huffington Post. Now, he's also a featured writer in the New Yorker Observer and the Village Voice, and is the author of Dead Star Twilight. As if that isn't enough, Chez is also a new media consultant, and he joins us on the line right now. Hi, Chez.
Hey there.
Thanks for being on the program with us. Wanted to talk to you about mainstream media versus digital media. Now, you've been in media for quite a while. You were in radio and television going back to the early 90s. So there's been quite a revolution in media since that period. Did you see any of this coming?
No, of course not. I don't think anybody did. The internet, when I first started, was a twinkle in somebody's eye. I'm sure it existed in some form. I've never really researched the history of it, but I things are moving so quickly now that there are things popping up every single day that I wouldn't have been able to see coming 2 years ago. There are probably people who are paid a lot more money to understand technology. Me, I've always sort of done the journalism thing and obviously participated in whatever new social networking platform came out, but I've never seen anything like this. It's actually tough to keep up with. I joke a lot of times that, when Twitter first came out, I thought to myself, I'm like, God, another platform that I have to sort of be some kind of slave to. And it gets tough after a while, and I understand. One of the things that I actually really have sort of come to understand as time has gone on is the kind of Luddite urge to pull the plug a little bit, because it gets exhausting. It's so fast. It's moving so quickly. And you're so, the links, the hyper-communication is so impressive that, at some point you just kind of want to say, all right, you know what, I'm going to shut down from all this for a little bit.
As someone who works as a new media consultant, do you find that sometimes, just generally speaking, people you deal with and businesses that have to deal with new media, as you said just a moment ago, are really having difficulty trying to keep up? It's like holding on to a high-speed merry-go-round, just clinging on for dear life.
Yeah. I mean, that's exactly what it is. It's almost impossible unless you're paying very, very close attention, or you're someone who's sort of naturally attuned to all the new technologies that are coming out, to the way that things are advancing, and to sort of having, it's more than just being attuned to the technology. You have to sort of understand how to use it. And quite frankly, I mean, you know, there's a sort of like, I hate to say it, but there's sort of like cool factor involved in keeping up with all of the social networking. You know, you have to know not just what's being advanced, but also how to sort of use it, how it can work for business, how it can work for you personally. And that's, it takes a hell of a lot. I mean, it's really, really tough to, it's really tough to keep up with. And yeah, I mean, if you're a business, especially, unless you pay people whose job it is, or unless you're one of those very special people yourself, or you pay people whose job it is to just follow this stuff very carefully, there's a pretty good chance you're going to get lost. I'm always amazed by the number of people in businesses who really don't understand even the most basic things about Facebook, Twitter, posters, you know, any of that. And yet, yeah, they're out there. I mean, you know, people are out there. For a lot of people, although, you know, if you're into social networking, new media, you learn to live by it. There are a ton of people out there who still don't really care all that much. They don't really know what it can do for them business-wise. They don't really know what it can do for them personally. And they're just sort of like, you know, they live their lives just fine without having to deal with all of the stuff that, you know, deal with all the stuff, all the hassles of social networking, but obviously reap the benefits as well. So, yeah, you know, it's very, once again, it's very, very tough to keep up.
Well, let's talk about the business model since you brought that up just a moment ago. I mean, you're someone who works for the Huffington Post or has a column with the Huffington Post, and it was pointed out just here in Canada recently in a television show called 16 by 9 on the Global Television Network, did a piece on Arianna Huffington, and they were bringing up the fact that the Huffington Post has been sold for a big whack of dough recently. And good for Arianna, but a lot of people who work for the Huffington Post, and I'm asking if this is the case with you, are not paid.
Oh yeah, no, you know, the bloggers don't get paid. That's been well known since day one, and I think that everybody kind of took it for, even if there was a little bit of resentment behind the scenes, everybody just sort of took it as, well, look, you know, you are getting exposure, and a lot of it, and that's kind of what Arianna traded on was, you know, you're getting a chance to be read by, you know, millions of people, and that has some value in it, and it does, it absolutely does, but yeah, I don't think it really, for a lot of people, I don't think it was really driven home just what the disparity is until the sale went through, and then it became, look, Arianna just made, you know, Arianna and her partners just made $315 million selling out the Huffington Post to what has always been, since its inception, the most sort of pedestrian, lowest common denominator path of least resistance to the Internet service provider that's ever existed in this country. You know, AOL has always been sort of a, you know, I really don't mean to be disparaging, but sort of the idiot's way to the Internet. You know, anybody could use it. They prided themselves on that. And here, Arianna has sold what was considered such a cutting-edge publication, and, yeah, just kind of handed it over to them. And what's more, you know, not long before she did that, you know, that very infamous memo came out where AOL CEO basically said, look, we're creating content farms here. We don't even give a crap what we, you know, what we put up as long as it generates hits and you know, and so she got kind of rightfully, I mean, I can't, you know, I see no reason to knock Arianna. I know her and I like her quite a bit. I think she's terrific. I mean, she's obviously a very, very shrewd businesswoman. But I can see where people would be upset. There's no doubt about it.
Do you think going forward, now that a price tag has been put on the Huffington Post and it sets the bar for other sites like the Huffington Post, do you think it sets the bar and gives an idea to people who contribute to such sites as to what their worth might be down the road and they might start asking for something?
You know, I don't know. I read a really interesting article, and I can't remember who wrote it a few days ago, by someone who basically said, you know, now you've been giving your business model newspapers, and what you can do as a newspaper now is create yourself a Huffington Post style website that's an offshoot of your brand, and pay bloggers $50 a pop to write stuff for you. And you can probably create something that is not only as massive as Huffington, which I'm not really 100% sure about. You need the name recognition with Ariane at work. I guess with a big newspaper, I have no doubt that it would work as well. But yeah, if you pay, the point with it, if you pay, you know, pay bloggers $50 a pop, you can create something that's probably very, very, you know, that's a very beneficial business model in almost no time. And on top of that, you'll be somewhat more beloved than, you know, the people who are grumbling about Ariana because of the fact that, look, you know, they, writers may not be making a fortune, but they're getting something. You know, the argument that people have always had against Huffington is, you know, there are people who write for Huffington who don't need the money. You know, every time Alec Baldwin contributes, or whenever, you know, one of our elected officials contributes or something like that, it's, you know, it's you look at them and you realize, look, they can rattle this crap off in their sleep, and it won't matter one bit because they're, you know, they're already worth a fortune. They don't need the money. But there are people who work, you know, who that's their biggest, you know, that's something they really, really put a lot of time and effort into. You know, one of my very close friends is a guy named Bob Sefka, who's probably their largest single blogger, meaning he's got a lot of other things going on. He does a radio show, and he does, you know, he writes, you know, has an animation company and writes for other outlets. But Huffington is really what he's sort of become known for. And he always gets, you know, very, very high placement on the page when he writes. And, you know, and he sets one day of his week aside and just cranks out a piece for Huffington. And, yeah, look, you know, he's gotten, it's led to, you know, what I have to believe are good things for him when it comes to notoriety and so on, but it doesn't pay the bills. So,
well, I've got just about a minute, so I want to find out what pays the bills for Chaz Pazienza. Tell us about your website as well.
I'm running a company called DXM Media right now. It's based out of, I basically travel a lot between Miami and New York. I was born in Miami. I lived a long time in New York. And we're doing, you know, social networking consulting with businesses and basically any kind of client, you know, political leaders, campaigns, products, any of that. And it's basically trying to sort of get in touch with the people that you need to get in touch with if you want your product to sell in the world of social media. And it's actually, like I said, it's a tough thing to do. It really is, because it's easy to say, well, I can just go on Facebook or I can just go on Twitter, but you have to know how to sort of get under the skin of the people who read that regularly. And one of the ways to do it is you can't BS them. It's a very sort of BS-proof, transparent BS-proof society. So, but I'm doing that, and I'm writing for Deus Ex Malcontent, which is my blog. That's the one that got me canned from CNN back in 2008. You know, I write for that regularly, and I just kind of overhauled the site just a little bit. But, I mean, that's my baby. I've been doing that for 5 years now. You know, and a few other little side projects. But, you know, it's nice. It's I'm doing something I enjoy, so I'm very lucky.
Chaz, thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Chaz Pazienza from the Huffington Post. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the Stuff File program page for this show, which is show number 0084, and you'll find links to Chaz's blog. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Now that spring has finally arrived, how will you mark the return of warmer weather? Will you clean off your bike and go for a ride? Or maybe take a hike in the woods? If you enjoy doing either of these activities on public trails, consider yourself lucky that you don't live in Connecticut. While you may be dusting off your bike this spring, thousands of outdoor enthusiasts in Connecticut are contacting their lawmakers instead. Because last year, a mountain biker who was injured while riding on a public trail there sued the local government and was awarded $3 million. That verdict is threatening to close trails now that people have used for years, and it's also affecting charities. A group of mountain bikers preparing new trails for a Live Strong charity project had to stop their work because of the lawsuit. Let's be fair, nowadays we can't take it for granted that activities we've always enjoyed will be there tomorrow. If you'd like to learn more about how excessive litigation is changing America and what you can do to help restore common sense, go to our website, centerforamerica.org.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio that puts a smile on your face and a skip in your step. Please avoid skipping if you are driving.
And still to come on the program, we'll meet Professor Splash. Plus, we have an idiot of the day. But before we get to that, one more Stuff File news story before we get to our last guest. A patient in surgery at Abbott Northwestern Hospital in Minneapolis, Minnesota, identified only as LVK, was screaming in pain. Registered nurse Sarah Mae Casaretto, age 33, was quick to step in, telling him to go to your happy place and man up, because she had already given him as much medication as allowed. Hospital staff had to hold LVK down to complete the procedure, and the patient later went to police. The problem? Casaretto had only given him a fraction of his dose. Police say she then shot the rest of it into herself instead. When confronted, Casaretto resigned from her job and allegedly admitted to police that she is addicted to painkillers. Hospital administrators declined to discuss why doctors would continue to operate on a patient who is screaming in pain. "We have procedures to protect patients," said hospital spokeswoman Gloria O'Connell, "and there are safeguards in place to ensure employees don't steal drugs." Really? Let's see you face LVK and say that same thing again, ma'am. Yeah. Have you seen Nurse Jackie on television, on cable? Yeah. Watch it. You might learn a thing or two. Yeah, anyway, let's get to our last guest here on the Stuff File program, speaking about pain, somebody who probably knows a lot about pain. America's Professor Splash has done it again. He's broken his own world record by diving from a 36-foot platform into a kiddie pool with just 12 inches of water. His real name is Darren Taylor, and he is indeed the world's greatest and most decorated shallow water diver. And he's on the line with us right now. Hi, Darren.
How you doing, Peter? Thanks for the invite again.
Thanks for being on with us once again. Now, you keep doing this into 12 feet of water, and I urge people to go to your website, which is professorsplash.com, and they can actually see video of this. But you keep doing this from 36 feet up in the air. How did this begin for you, and does it ever end?
You know, Peter, started out as a hobby. Now it's a dangerous hobby. It has a life of its own. I was happy 5 years ago to get a world record. No one wanted to pick this up because it was so dangerous 5 years ago, so I did it in the back of my friend's yard. And once I got ratified as being the highest shallow diver, you know, I've had a lot of work since then, and now I'm locked in contracts where I got to shake off a bad dive, and, you know, I have to go on because I'm in contracts, you know.
Is this something that's actually a full-time job for you?
Yes, it is now, you know, and I'm not one to brag. I've been very humble with my diving. I've been a professional high diver for 25 years. This started out as a clown dive off the 3-meter. It's the flat. You go out and you do like a breakaway man out of the audience break-in comedy with diving shows, and the guy comes up there and does the flat, and everybody laughs about it. So, you know, I've been doing these flats on purpose, and, of course, I was a 10-meter platform diver when I was 12 years old in competition. So I've been around 10 meters, but to be able to, you know, come down and have the discipline to land flat to dissipate the energy in the water, to be able to use it as a cushion effect for survival. You know, I'm above 36 feet now, and it's just, it's really, it's up there now.
Now, this latest record, which is, I believe, is your 13th Guinness certified record, you did this one in Norway. How do the different locations come into play here?
You know, when, like I say, it's exciting. I've been a professional high diver for 25 years, and now I have my own act. I was always a real good, you know, dedicated professional high diver for water show production companies around the world. I toured through China, Canada, Europe, you know, all over the world doing theme shows. And then now I have my own show, but it has a life of its own. And I will sit, since I've been getting a lot of, you know, it keeps getting bigger. It's just, it's like, it's a snowball effect where in America, I really don't have the play that I have, you know, in Europe and also in Asia, where I've done this in front of 300 million people, you know, in six countries and, you know, a lot of world records. So people know who I am over in Europe, and they're starting to, you know who I am here in America, but it's still a big thing overseas.
Okay, so let's clarify this. The bottom of the pool, I understand, is not inflated, because that would be against the Guinness rules, correct?
Right, correct.
So it's the kind of, almost like a kid's wading pool? Is that what it's like?
It's a kid's wading pool, you know, and with, you've seen some of my films on YouTube. I'm all over YouTube, you know, if I'm Googled and everything else, I've got some great films on there. But also, Guinness has a requirement. You've got to have some foam, a little piece of foam under there for safety, of course, but we also use it for leveling, because I've never jumped on a site that was ever level. And every inch counts, so I want to use, you know, something to level everything out. But, you know, from 36 feet, you know, landing in, you know, to 12 inches of water, it's a flat bottom pool. The pool is really narrow. I actually look down, at, you know, before I dive, and I'm going, wow. And, you know, what's coming into play also is I've had, you know, I'm going to have to get some contacts. It's going to come into play where I'm so high now where I just can't see the dives, especially at night. But Norway was special. I jumped in. I proved to everybody that I could jump in the winter like that, and it was extremely cold, and I was actually scared that the pool was going to rupture. A big layer of ice on it.
Have you ever injured yourself doing one of these dives?
Yes. I've had some moderate concussions where, you know, it makes math a little difficult for about a week, you know, where, and it's not a laughing matter, but I've done world records and have been yelled at by my, you know, my superiors, my advisors, my close friends, my veteran vultures, you know, people who've been around the business who are not easily impressed, you know, and they're tough on me and they say, don't take this for granted, which I never have, but I've had some of these dives get away from me. And it's, you know, I've done, you know, a lot of them, and they're all, it's like an experimental thing here. I've done 10,000 high dives from 80, 90, and 100 feet over, you know, 25 years, but these things, I've only got a handful of these really, and sometimes the height and the conditions and everything else, and I'm scared, you know, sometimes my emotions, you know, I calm down before I do this, but still, before, I mean, I'm a stunt diver. I'm not a daredevil, so I admit that, you know, there's some nerves there.
Okay, we're talking 36 feet above the ground into a very narrow pool. You yourself mentioned sometimes it's difficult to even see it from that height. Are you concerned?
Don't look at it. Look at it. If you look at that pool, you're in trouble. I never, ever look at that pool. I'm actually jumping up into a very brilliant, strong, very rigid swan dive to get the dive stuck. If you jump into orbit, you're perfect. If you flounder off that perch and you have inconsistent ladder separation, okay, you're in trouble. And that's with high diving and also with springboard diving. You've got to have good, you know, board separation where you've got to be able to look up in the air, take everything up in the air. I was trained when I was 10 years old. Take everything up in the air. Get your dive done, and there in the bottom would be, you know, rather, you know, it'll be just like your top, okay? If you have a good top, good bottom. So I've been doing diving since I was 4 years old and, you know, really got serious about it when I was 15. And now I am a professional shallow diver. And it's very important to be able to get this to dive. It's a front dive that never happens.
Okay, but Darren, the thing I was getting at is, at 36 feet up, even a slight breeze must be a concern. Aren't you worried about the wind?
Yes, I'm moving. Perches, some of the platforms are different, where I'll get up there, and I've actually sprung off a couple of them. Some of them have been, you know, real rigid, but they've been, the whole setup has been moving around. I've had gangplanks where I've been off a lot of perches that move around, but I'm a really good diver, and I know how to dive, you know, in inconsistent platforms. But it all comes down to one thing: know what you're doing, and study, okay? Study. As long as you have a good mechanical device that you know you're not going to have any problem with that as far as cables or welds or something like that, as long as you study what you've got, I'm in control. This is no bungee, no parachutes, you know, something that I could have a catastrophic mechanical failure, and that's what usually gets, you know,
okay,
performers.
So you have your 13th Guinness certified record. You've now hit 36 feet. how much higher, how much further can you go? Is there a limit to what can be done here?
Well, yeah, because no one knows that after I did Norway, I got a slight concussion. You know, I got up and everything else, but the next day when I had to transfer back, you know, through airports and stuff to get, you know, back from Norway over here, my head started swelling, and I was I had some layovers back over here in Chicago, and I was having trouble in the airport where I'd actually have some help, you know, where that's never happened before, but I think it's my first modern head concussion, and I'm landing perfect. I'm landing perfect, and I'm starting to take injuries. So, yeah, it's coming close now where I have some contracts. I've got three contracts coming up that are huge, that are real huge, one in Brazil and one here in Florida. And then I'm after that, I'm actually no longer accepting, you know, offers right now. I'm just saying I'm going to put everything right now and see how I, you know, where I go from here, because I want to get out of this thing. And there's a lot of other things that I want to pursue. I've been studying Guinness World Records since I was 13.
Darren,
I had to get the book.
Darren, how old are you now?
I'm 50 years old.
50. The reason why I asked the question is the problems you've been facing with this last jump that you had, is it having to do with the increased height or the fact that your body just can't take it anymore, or a combination of the two? In other words, if you were the Darren Taylor who started this oh so many years ago, that you could go even higher than the 36 feet you're doing now?
Vertigo's starting to wipe me out, and I don't know how to handle that. I'm starting to talk to some specialists where the difference between me and a commoner, okay, I hate to say that word, but someone who's not a professional high diver, is that I've got to jump it. And I'm talking some terrible vertigo. I'm talking anticipation of me jumping these world records where I've got 10 television sets going on at once. And I'm starting to tip over and have anxiety problems where I can't take medication because I got to have a clear head. No alcohol, no nothing. Okay, I've gone off on that a few times where I've had a few Cheerios, and you start getting, you know, you start getting some fake hope, and then when, you know, that's not the right way to do that, saying to be, you know, clear, fly clear and fly, you know, with experience. And that's the only thing that has got me through these things is I've said to myself, hey, cool it. You have experience. You've done this. It's just a little bit higher. Do what you need to do, okay? Do your job. And I get through these things, but it's starting to really wear on me now, or I'm starting to, you know, have trouble, break down. I had a couple of interviews over in Norway where I had to cancel them. I had a radio interview where I started getting emotional about, you know, my daughter. My daughter's my manager, and she wasn't out of town with me for this world record. And I was upset about that. I wanted to have her there. And, you know, I started getting a little choked up about it and very emotional.
Well, Darren, we're
this has death all over it, okay? this has death all over it, and I don't know why I do it. I'm locked into it. I'm very fortunate to do it, but there's a good side and there's a dark side of this thing. But it's a feel-good story, but on my side, it's drastic, and it can wear on you, and it's killing me inside, and I want to get rid of it.
Well, Darren, congratulations on your record, and hope you'll, you know, play it safe and don't do this for too long of a period of time. People can check out your website, which is professorsplash.com. I thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you very much, and it's always good to talk with you, okay? And I'll see you in the very near future, okay, Peter?
Okay, Darren. That's Darren Taylor, better known as Professor Splash. You can check out his website at professorsplash.com. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the Stuff File program page for this show, which is show number 0084, and you'll find the links to Darren's website. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for an Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
28-year-old Marissa Mark has certainly never read the book Hiring a Hitman for Dummies. She's been charged with trying to hire someone to kill a California woman identified only by the initials ALR, and she did it through a website called hitmanforhire.com and used PayPal to pay the $19,000 bill. Mark was arrested at her home in Jersey City, New Jersey, and had an initial appearance in Allentown. She provided hitmanforhire.com a full description of the woman and her work address and agreed to pay $37,000 total for the murder. The initial $19,000 paid through PayPal used stolen or unauthorized credit card accounts. She agreed to pay the remaining $18,000 when the murder was completed. She's now facing numerous charges, all of which could get her 56 years in prison. And by the way, no sense in checking out hitmanforhire.com. The website no longer exists. Why would someone think a good way to find a hitman would be to consult a website and then try to pay said hitman with stolen credit card accounts via PayPal? One reason and one reason only. She's an idiot.
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0084. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. And you'll find all the information and links and all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and again, that's 0084. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com, or you can find me on Twitter and Facebook as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can find a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show, on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, aboard China Airlines, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. I'm your announcer, your name here. Oh, I'm sorry. This is Ben Patrick Johnson. What am I being paid for this? What? You're flipping kidding me. Okay, that's it. Turn off the microphone.